Hello, this is Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, May 15, 2025. Area police tout use of mental health co-response teams. This being National Mental Health Awareness Month, members of area police departments used their time at the Champaign County Community Coalition on Wednesday to champion co-response teams. Champaign police are new to the club, joining the Urbana and University of Illinois departments in forming response teams prepared to deal with issues that might lead to 911 call, but that police aren't typically trained to handle. The Champaign City Council recently approved a plan to have a licensed clinical social worker lead a team of co-responders, individuals who can help people undergoing personal mental health crises, following first responders to focus on areas where their skills would be better utilized. Champaign Police Chief Tim Tyler celebrated the decision. "I've always said about the city of Champaign, they always put their money where their mouth is," Tyler said. "It's going to cost a lot, but they believe so much in the community that we're willing to make sure that we have the mental health resources that we need." Tyler is hoping to hire locally for the team and encouraged area residents to apply to positions, which Champaign Police spokesperson Joe Lamberson said will be posted later this year as the program comes together. "We want you to come work for the city of Champaign. It's the greatest place to work for. It's just the greatest," Tyler said. Urbana Chief Larry Boone said he'd refrain from commenting on if Champaign was the greatest, but praised his own department's similar program. U of I Police Captain Jason Bradley said that his department's co-response team was recognized with a department award last month for spending 6 weeks working with a chronically homeless individual with mental health concerns. Co-response team officer Betsy Alfonso and crisis worker and licensed social worker Jessica Wilson were able to help the individual get access to his finances, safe housing, and ongoing mental health support. "A lot of people drove past him every day and walked past him without paying much attention," Bradley said. "But Wilson and Alfonso, they listened to him, they believed him, and they helped him help solve some of the problems that were causing some difficulty in his life." Bradley also reported that the U of I department is experiencing a calm few months around the corner, with students headed home for the summer, and that's almost time to visit campus restaurants while they're less crowded. The Champaign, Urbana, and Sheriff's Departments each reported they are investigating shooting incidents with atypical circumstances. On April 18th, sheriff's deputies responded to a residence in St. Joseph for a report of a shooting, only to learn that the shooting had occurred around 3 weeks earlier. There were no injuries, and the victim named one suspect. Deputies gathered evidence and several witness statements before interviewing the suspects, but have not made an arrest. Tyler said that last month the Champaign Department received an unconfirmed report of an individual being shot, but the individual is out of town and not supporting law enforcement efforts with the investigation. Boone said that on April 12th, an individual arrived at Carl Foundation Hospital, Urbana, with a gunshot wound to the hip, but declined to share any information on where the shooting occurred and said he was the only person injured. Boone also shared that a firearm missing after an incident in which a juvenile shot a dog on April 6th has since been discovered. There's a picture on the front page with the caption, "Soon to graduate University of Illinois senior, Tanisha Gajar holds up her mortarboard while a friend snaps her photo Wednesday at the orange-colored fountain at Illinois and Lincoln." Sometimes life throws you big curveballs. Four-time medalist at Paralympics delivering commencement address. Retired U.S. Paralympian Nicole Millage, a Parkland College graduate who has won four medals, has been tapped to deliver the keynote address at the college's commencement set for 7 p.m. today at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. In the summer of 1997, the Champaign native was in a boating accident that severely injured her left hand and damaged her lower left leg to the point it had to be amputated. She discovered a passion for sitting volleyball and was given this opportunity to join the U.S. national team in March 2005. Millage began training full-time in the sport at the University of Central Oklahoma, where she earned a master's degree in business administration in 2012. She participated in four Paralympics as a member of sitting volleyball teams that won silver in 2008 in Beijing and 2012 in London, and gold in 2016 in Rio de Janeiro and 2021 in Tokyo. Our community's editor, Dave Hinton, chatted with her ahead of her keynote address. One-on-one with graduation speaker Nicole Millage. You have overcome difficult times to excel as a Paralympian. Were there ever times after your accident when you felt like giving up? There were definitely challenging times after my accident. I didn't know any other amputees, and I didn't know anything about prosthetics, but I was very fortunate to have such supportive people around me. My family and friends made sure that I didn't go through anything alone. I never felt like giving up, but I would certainly say that I definitely felt a little lost after my accident. I think that's to be expected. My life was obviously forever changed, but I had no idea exactly what that meant at the time. I could have never predicted everything that was to come. Where did you draw your strength from to forge ahead? My motivation came from wanting to show people that I could get back to my old life. At that time, it meant getting back to playing sports with a prosthetic leg. I wanted to prove to others, as well as to myself, that I could still do it, and that's exactly what I did. What will your message be to the graduates at Thursday's commencement? My message will focus on unexpected detours in life, and if any of them are struggling with finding their path, I want them to know they're not alone. It's a common feeling for young folks, as well as graduates, to maybe have some uncertainties about their future. Of course, I had something pretty traumatic happen in the middle of my time at Parkland, a boating accident at Clinton Lake in 1998. But what I learned is to not fear the unknown. Sometimes life throws you big curveballs, and it's easy to feel overwhelmed or defeated, but I always encouraged people to do their best to embrace these challenges or surprises, because sometimes the deepest lessons and the most transformative moments happen off the beaten path. What role has Parkland played in your education? Parkland was there for me at a time when my life was a bit derailed, but I was extremely proud of myself for getting back in the saddle and accomplishing my goal of graduating from college. I had tremendous support from professors and fellow students. Parkland also provided me with a sense of normalcy during a pretty turbulent time in my life. Where do you live and where do you work? I live in Champaign with my fiancé, Ryan Faust, and I work for the City of Champaign as an environmental sustainability specialist. My primary duties are overseeing the city's recycling programs, services, and activities, including co-hosting electronics recycling events that take place out at Parkland College. Shriners and Carl partner on staging orthopedic clinics here each quarter. Until recently, parents in Champaign-Urbana who needed to have children seen by Shriners Children's Hospitals would have their pick of Chicago or St. Louis as the closest locations. However, due to a new partnership between Shriners and Carl Health, local families now have the opportunity to get that orthopedic care closer to home 4 times a year. Carl is hosting clinics on a quarterly basis that are staffed by providers from Shriners Chicago and St. Louis locations, said Shriners Hospital Administrator Mark Venable. The first of these was held at Carl at the Fields in late March, and the next is set for May 28th. It could be anything from a new patient who has been seen by a health care provider and was referred to see an orthopedic specialist, to an existing patient of ours who has just a follow-up appointment, Venable said. The goal there is that we're bringing that specialty pediatric orthopedic care closer to home for those families. He said that these clinics will mirror a typical visit to Shriners for general orthopedic, scoliosis, neuromuscular disease, cerebral palsy, or upper and lower extremity conditions. Shriners will alternate between having physicians from the Chicago and St. Louis hospitals at these clinics. The March event featured a St. Louis provider, and the upcoming clinic will feature a Chicago provider. The March clinic was fantastic, said Caleb Miller, Senior Vice President of Specialty and Ambulatory Care at Carl. It went great. Every single patient that came through there was so appreciative of being able to obtain their service and not have to make that drive. One actually remarked that this saved her a hotel stay as well as a 7-hour drive back and forth. He added that while the March clinic was more of a soft opening, future clinics will be all-day events and be held at least quarterly, and then we'll adjust frequency as needed. The collaboration with Carle Health is really a focus on our strategic visions at Shriners Children's about seeing more kids in more places, Venable said. And here within the Midwest, we identified Central Illinois as a location where we could execute that vision. As Shriners looked for potential partners, they found that Carle Health had a similar mission to ours, which led to conversations about local outreach, she said. It aligns directly with Carle Health's commitment to providing exceptional patient-centered care and ensuring that specialized services are available to these patients where they need it most, which is obviously closest to home, Miller said. And another photo on the first page has the title, Challenge Accepted, and the caption, Jim Smith, part of a volunteer crew from Bourne Russo, congratulates Buddy Addison Franklin as she scores during a CU Kiwanis Challenger League game Tuesday at Ambucks Park, Urbana. A record number of players are involved in year 28. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. The rain held off at Urbana's Ambucks Park on Tuesday, allowing the determined kids of the CU Kiwanis Tom Jones Challenger League to enjoy another night of fun, food, and friendship. Year 28 of a league that gives children facing physical and mental challenges the opportunity to play baseball is shaping up to be the most successful yet, with a record number of participants, 10 teams, 140 players, with room for more. Games are played Tuesday nights and Saturday mornings and bring out the best in all involved. A crew from Brewer and Russo volunteered on Tuesday, as they do every spring, grilling hot dogs and helping on the field. To register as a player or volunteer the rest of the season, visit tomjonesleague.org or call Celeste Eichelberger 217-377-7935. Teacher of the Week, Jennifer Nolan, Special Education, Tuscola High School. Throughout her 32 career as a special education teacher, Jennifer Nolan has taught everything from the most basic life skills, such as using utensils to eat, to math and reading. After a long stretch teaching at Salt Fork Schools, the Danville native has taught at Tuscola High School for the past 5 years. I find my work important because throughout my career I've had the opportunity to teach a wide range of skills, from life skills like toileting, toothbrushing, and pulling on shoes and socks, to fine and gross motor skills, and academic subjects like reading, writing, math, science, and social studies. I've taught students everything from how to use a fork to how to use exponents. My students have diverse needs and strengths, and my job has always been to meet them where they are and help them grow in every area of their lives. I became a teacher because I loved elementary school. I played school during the summer growing up. I was always a teacher and would recruit the younger kids in the neighborhood to be my students. I just knew I wanted to help people. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is, my most unique lesson involves working with a speech therapist when I taught life skills. We would use fun things like painting to teach language skills, following directions, and fine motor skills. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when I see students being successful in their lives after they graduate and knowing that I contributed in some way. I keep students engaged by figuring out what an individual student needs. I work with students with a wide variety of academic, social, and emotional needs. Engagement often starts with trust and support in an environment where students feel safe and understood. Something else I'm passionate about is advocating for my students. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was Miss Patsy Jones at Southview Middle School. I loved English, specifically reading novels. If I weren't a teacher, I would be maybe a librarian or a social worker. How WLS developed its statewide dominance. This is Mike Hale's Records and Radio column. A reader's question sent me down a J. Mark Powell type rabbit hole. But first, this week's quiz question. When you combine the Billboard Hot 100 Singles Chart and the Billboard Top 200 Album Chart from this century, name the five biggest artists of the last 25 years, 2000 to 2024. Answer at the end of the column. Rob Pedlow noted how strong WLS showed up in the 1977 Champaign Urbana radio ratings. I shared in my last column his question, WLS was that dominant of a rock station outside of Chicago? Dating to the early 1960s, two major market AM top 40 radio stations split the state in terms of listening. The Big 89 WLS was huge in CU, Danville, Decatur, Bloomington, Peoria, Quad Cities, and Rockford. The Big 630 KXOK in St. Louis was dominant in Quincy, Springfield, and over toward Terre Haute, Indiana, and through Carbondale to the confluence of the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. In the 60s, there were a handful of lower power AM top 40 stations spread around. Stations like WITY Danville, WCVS Springfield, WDZ Decatur, WIRL Peoria, KSTT Quad Cities, WROK and WYFE Rockford, WBOW Terre Haute, WGGH Marion, and WKYX and WDXR in Paducah, Kentucky. Each of these stations did well in their respective markets, but over their shoulder was always the Big 89 and or the Big 630. It is safe to say, based on the radio ratings through 70s, that 80% of the car radios in Illinois had a push button for WLS and or KXOK. The glory years of major market AM top 40 radio in the 60s and 70s was powerful stuff. Strong personalities all day, all night, all weekend. Award-winning 24/7 news departments. A strong commitment to public service. Non-stop promotions. The very best jingles. Full-time engineers who maintained a perfect audio chain from the studio through to the transmitter. And a distinctive signature sound that was different from every other radio station on the dial. On May 2, 1960, the new sound of WLS took to the air and in short order quickly displaced local competitors WIND and WJJD in the ratings, plus within 170 miles of the WLS transmitter site in Tinley Park, teens and young adults quickly became loyal listeners day and night. At night, listeners in 38 states made WLS the number one alternative to their local stations. The music was great, but it was personalities who made listeners extremely loyal to the brand. No two DJs on WLS sounded the same. Dick Biondi, Art Roberts, Ron Riley, Clark Weber, and later Larry Lujack, Bob Surratt, Tommy Edwards, and John Records Landecker. Fred Winston and Yvonne Daniels executed the WLS format to perfection as it evolved through the years. The Big 89 had good program directors. The best, without question, was John Garone, who led WLS to victory once and for all over pesky crosstown competitor WCFL. He brought Larry Lujack to morning radio. Wasn't music radio one of the best radio positioning statements of the 70s? Garone methodically tweaked WLS over the years to ensure the mix of personalities, music, promotions, news, and public service would put the station in a position to dominate for another decade. As the 70s came to a close, AM Top 40 radio began a fast decline and subsequent quick death at the hands of more music FM stations, but WLS continued to dominate thanks to incredible brand loyalty. In the last Arbitron ratings of the 70s for Champaign-Urbana, WLS tied with WKAO K104 for number one each with a 14.3 share. WLS was still number three with 60,000 different listeners in Bloomington, number three in Peoria with 96,000, number four in Quad Cities with 117,000, and number three in Rockford with 103,000. I've edited down this column more than any other I have written. I still didn't get everything in. I'll finish it in the next installment, plus jump into some other topics you've asked about. Thanks for your feedback and questions. Tax bill clears committee. CBO, GOP proposal would cost millions of Americans their health insurance and SNAP benefits. Cheers broke out early Wednesday as Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee signed off on the GOP tax breaks bill after a grueling round-the-clock session that pushed President Donald Trump's package past overwhelming Democratic opposition. But there's still more work to do. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, also worked past midnight trying to resolve issues with Trump's plan. Opposition is mounting from various corners of the GOP majority as he tries to muscle the party's signature package to passage without any votes from Democrats. On the one hand, the conservative leader of the Freedom Caucus derides the new Medicaid work requirements as a joke that do not go far enough at cost-cutting. Meanwhile, a handful of GOP lawmakers from New York and other high-tax states are refusing to support the measure unless changes are made to give deeper state and local tax deductions, called SALT, for their constituents back home. "To say we have a gulf is an understatement," said Representative Chip Roy, Republican, Texas, a leader of the conservative wing. Roy said there is a significant number of us who could not bless the product in its current form. Nevertheless, momentum is building toward an end-of-the-week inflection point to stitch together the sprawling package. That means combining hundreds of pages of bill text covering $5 trillion in tax breaks and at least $1.5 trillion in spending reductions on Medicaid, food stamps, and green energy programs to deliver Trump's second-term legislative priority. Democrats decry the packages as a giveaway to the wealthy at the expense of safety net programs that millions of Americans rely on. But Johnson insists the Republican majority is on track to pass the package by Memorial Day, May 26th. Sending it to the Senate, where Republicans are crafting their own version, with his slim majority, he can only afford a few defections from his ranks. "We're still on target," Johnson said at the Capitol. "The American people are counting on us." Democrats also stayed up all night, forcing marathon public hearings, one at the House Energy and Commerce Committee, was still going more than 26 hours later before finishing Wednesday afternoon. All told, Democrats proposed hundreds of amendments, trying to change the package with dozens of votes that largely failed. "It is a cruel, mean, rotten bill," said Representative Jim McGovern, Democrat, Massachusetts, as the House Agriculture Committee debated changes to the Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program known as SNAP. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said at least 7.6 million fewer people would have health insurance with the changes to Medicaid, and possibly more with additional changes to the Affordable Care Act. The CBO also gave lawmakers a preliminary analysis showing that 3 million fewer people each month will participate in the SNAP food program under the changes proposed. More than 70 million Americans rely on Medicaid for health care, and about 40 million use SNAP. The Republicans are targeting Medicaid and SNAP for a combined $1 trillion in cuts as a way to offset the costs of the tax package, but also to achieve GOP goals of reinforcing in the social safety net programs. Most of the cost savings would come from impossible, stiffer work requirements for those receiving the health care and food assistance, meaning fewer people would qualify for the aid. The legislation would raise from 54 to 64 the age of able-bodied adults without dependents who would have to work to qualify for SNAP. It also would require some parents of children older than 7, it's now 18, to work to qualify for the benefits. Under current law, those recipients must work or participate in a work program for 80 hours a month. The chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, Representative Brett Guthrie, Republican, Kentucky, insists the changes would strengthen and sustain Medicaid for the future and are the kind of common-sense policies Trump promised voters. But Democrats told repeated stories of their constituents struggling to access health care. Representative Jimmy Gomez, Democrat, California, revealed his own diagnosis with type 2 diabetes at the House Ways and Means Committee, that hearing in the sticker shock of health costs. Democrats had proposals to revive subsidies to help people buy insurance through the Affordable Care Act. Most of the amendments were failing. One of the most difficult issues for Johnson has been the more localized debate over state and local taxes as he works to come up with a compromise for New York, California, and New Jersey lawmakers. They have rejected an offer to triple the deduction cap, now at $10,000 to $30,000 for married couples. The speaker met for more than an hour with lawmakers in his office and later into the night. Representative Nick LaLota, Republican New York, said the talks were cordial, but there was no deal. More sizzle than steak in the meeting, he said late Tuesday. The reality is you need 218 votes to pass a bill. And the way this bill is currently constructed, it will not have that because it does not adequately the issue of SALT, said Representative Mike Lawler, Republican New York. Environmental Protection Agency. Limits on forever chemicals in drinking water to be rolled back. The Environmental Protection Agency said Wednesday that it plans to weaken limits on some forever chemicals in drinking water that were finalized last year while maintaining standards for two common ones. The Biden administration set the first federal drinking water limits for PFAS, or perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substance, finding they increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, certain cancers, and babies being born with low birth weights. Those limits on PFAS, which are human-made and don't easily break down in nature, were expected to reduce their levels for millions of people. Limits on three types of PFAS include what are known as Gen X substances found in North Carolina will be scrapped and reconsidered by the agency, as will a limit on a mixture of several types of PFAS. The Biden administration will also set standards for the two common types of PFAS referred to as PFOA and PFOS at 4 parts per trillion, effectively the lowest level at which they can be reliably detected. The EPA will keep those standards but give utilities 2 extra years until 2031 to comply. We are on a path to uphold the agency's nationwide standards to protect Americans from PFOA and PFOS in their water. At the same time, we will work to provide common sense flexibility in the form of additional time for compliance, said EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin. The development was first reported by the Washington Post. It appears few utilities will be impacted by the withdrawal of limits of PFAS. So far, sampling has found nearly 12% of U.S. water utilities are above the Biden administration's limits, but most utilities face problems with PFOA and PFOS. Health advocates praised Biden's administration for the limits, but water utilities complained, saying treatment systems are expensive and that customers will end up paying more. The utilities sued the EPA. The EPA's actions align with some arguments in the utilities lawsuit. They argued that EPA lacked authority to regulate a mixture of PFAS and said the agency didn't properly support limits on several newer types of PFAS that the EPA now plans to rescind. They also sought the 2-year extension. Eric Olson, a senior strategist at the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council, said the move is illegal. The Safe Water Drinking Act gives the EPA authority to limit water contaminants, and it includes a provision meant to prevent new rules from being looser than previous ones. With a stroke of the pen, EPA is making a mockery of the Trump administration's promise to deliver clean water for Americans, Olson said. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, May 15, 2025. Please stay tuned for Part 2.